Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
We shall overcome. We shall overcome.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Long before Beethoven and Bono, Mahler or Miley Cyrus, there was the first song. It helped early humans tell stories, find food, and warn their children of danger. Fast forward tens of thousands of years and we're awash in music. It's the age of Guitar Hero, American Idol, and the iPod. Our guest today says that even millions of songs later, there are just six types of song. And they help us tell stories, tell a story of music and human evolution. This hour On Point, music, human nature, and the world in six songs. You can join the conversation. Where does the human need for song come from? Do we still sing about the same things we always have? What's in your iPod? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Montreal is Daniel Levitin. He runs the Laboratory for Music Perception, Cognition, and Expertise at McGill University. He's also worked as a musician, a record producer, and an audio specialist for the U.S. Navy. His last book, This Is Your Brain on Music, was an international bestseller translated into six languages. His new book is The World in Six Songs, How the Musical Brain Created Human Nature. Daniel Levitin, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
So you spent 10 years as an award-winning record producer working with the likes of Stevie Wonder and the Grateful Dead and Eric Clapton. How'd you leave all that to master the science of music?
Well, in the 1990s, when the music business started to fall apart, I think, you know, a lot of people saw the writing on the wall that the state that it's in now, I think, was foreseeable. A number of us left the industry. A friend of mine who was Madonna's recording engineer went to law school, and he's now a lawyer with the EPA. And I decided to take up an old hobby of mine, which was reading about the brain and science. I went back to school and found that the answers to a lot of the questions that I had had in the studio, like where does creativity come from or why do we get goosebumps, these questions were being addressed by neuroscientists.
Hmm. And so what are the six types of songs that you, in your study, in your research, have found that have shaped our human experience?
Well, the six kinds of songs are songs for friendship or social bonding, joy, comfort, knowledge, religion, and love. And any given song might fit in more than one category. I mean, these aren't exclusive categories. But I think that all the songs that we make and have made can fit into those six.
Hmm. And so how do those songs play into what we know about how the brain works as far as, well, how we hear music and we hear types of songs that fit into those categories you just mentioned?
Well, let's take social bonding songs, friendship songs, for example. We now know from a number of studies that when people sing together or make music together, the hormone oxytocin is released. This is the same chemical that's released when you have an orgasm. Now, it's easy to see the evolutionary advantage of that. I mean, evolution selected for good feeling and bonding to occur because it needed to find a way to help the man stick around and help raise the baby. The oxytocin release helped the man to feel bonded to the woman that he was with. But the fact that we get the same chemical reaction when we make music together, well, that suggests an intriguing role for music in the evolution of cooperation.
Hmm. It's not just oxytocin, it's serotonin and dopamine and T-cell production levels that increase during the time that we listen to music. Is that right?
You're absolutely right, Jane. There are different kinds of music and in different people and in different ways produce a different kind of neurochemical cocktail.
So what leads to that variation in different people?
Well, all of us are wired really in some respects in the same way, but there are a lot of individual variations. One of the things that's been most fascinating in the last 20 years of neuroscience is the ability to actually see the brain at work while it's thinking, the so-called neuroimaging experiments. And one of the striking things is that no two brains are alike. They're as different as fingerprints. They're wired differently. They function differently. Mm.
And we used to think, as you say in your book, that music affected just one part of the brain. But over the last 20 years, you say in the book, that music now, we've learned, affects every part of the brain. Is that right? Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, the old story was, well, the left brain is the logical brain and the right brain is the kind of artistic brain. And it turns out that, like many notions we held, it's overly simplistic. Music affects and impacts every part of the brain that we've so far mapped, from the most primitive parts of the brain that we share with all reptiles and vertebrates, the cerebellum, the brainstem, all the way up to the higher centers of the prefrontal cortex that only we humans have. It's in the left brain, the right brain. It affects emotional centers and seats of higher thought. I think the interesting thing is that music can activate so many different parts of the brain, more so than anything else that we know of.
Hmm. So tell us exactly what happens in our brains when we hear music. What's actually going on in there?
Well, what I call the musical brain came up as a result of what I think the research shows are three distinct evolutionary changes that Homo sapiens have that Neanderthals and that other primates don't have. One of them is the ability to take a perspective. We realize that not everybody thinks the same thoughts that we think or feels the same things we are. We can hear a song and realize that the singer or the composer is expressing something that we're not necessarily feeling, but that they're feeling. We can have a sort of empathetic reaction to that.
Hmm. Here's one composer, Brahms. He crafted the famous Lullaby as a Bedtime Blessing for Children, and now this song, of course, is so embedded in our culture that it's practically synonymous with sleep. So scientifically speaking, when you hear that, tell us what's going on in the brain, especially the brain of a child.
Well, in the brain of a child, the child is learning to, from a very early age, even in the womb, the child is learning to make sense of the structure and organization of musical signals. Even in the womb, children are learning systems of scales and tonal relationships. The young child is learning the rules of music just as they learn the rules of language, so that by the age of five, most children can tell you when there's a note out of place or a chord that's incorrect. And this particular piece, apart from its cultural association of a lullaby and being soothing, it has a lot of the kind of stylistic elements of comforting music. There's slow motion, the slow attack of the violins. It's not the staccato fanfare of a trumpet, for example. It's a slow tempo. It's interesting that you chose this because I think of it as kind of the archetypal comfort song, comfort being one of the six kinds. And mothers of every culture instinctively sing to their children. And we think that one of the reasons for this is that in our hunter-gatherer days, remember, a lot of the things that we do now were selected for by evolution over tens of thousands of years. We have brain reactions or behaviors that in many respects are informed by the way life was a long, long time ago. Our hunter-gatherer ancestors, both the man and the woman, both parents would be out collecting berries. It wasn't always practical to have the infant physically touching you. But the infant would be, typically a young infant, would feel some separation from the mother. The thing about song or any vocal communication is that the mother can reassure the infant that she's still there through the sound of her voice, even though she's not touching the child.
So it's a survival technique in some ways.
It is. It helps the infant to feel secure, to know that he or she's going to be okay. And by just a few weeks of age, the infant can recognize the sound of his or her mother's voice as distinct from other voices. It's a remarkable bond that's able to form through sound.
You also talk in the book about how human songs were a way of warning of danger. How so?
Well, I think that it's important to realize that before we had the written word, before anybody thought of putting something on paper, parchment, or stone tablets for that matter, we had to rely on memory and instructions like how to build a canoe or how to boil this plant so that it wouldn't be poisonous, where to look for water if your well ran dry, basic survival information, which animals to avoid, or you know, things like that, had to be memorized. It had to be passed down. And song was the most effective way of doing that. Songs have internal constraints of rhyme and rhythm and meter that help you to remember the words much more fluidly and easily than if the words were presented just in a textual instruction. Mm.
I just have about a minute left before our first break. Daniel Levitin, is there record of the first song?
Well, there isn't. The thing about sound, of course, is that until we invented phonograph records, or at least a way of notating music a few hundred years ago, it was only oral. There was no way to preserve it. Now, we do have song lyrics preserved from as long as 6,000 years ago from Persian culture. And, of course, the psalms that we read in the Old Testament were song lyrics written by King Solomon. We can only speculate about what the first song might have been.
Fascinating. Daniel Levitin, the book is The World in Six Songs. We're talking this hour about how musical nature, how our musical natures, and why humans have such a deep-seated need for music and dance and performance. You can join our conversation. What has music meant to you? What songs have brought you closer to someone or helped you through a difficult time? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Here's some music on the way out of a different sort. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Wish I could caress and a kiss. Manic depression is a frustrating mess. Love me tender, love me sweet. Never let me go.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about music, dance, and the brain, why humans have such a profound need for musical expression. You can join our conversation. What's in your stereo or your iPod right now? Do you play music with friends or sing in a church choir? What does it mean to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me today is Daniel Levitin, professor of music, neuroscience, and psychology at McGill University. He's author of the new book, The World in Six Songs, How the Musical Brain Created Human Nature. Daniel, I'm interested in some of the studies that you have done, some of the research, and I wish you'd tell us some of it now. You used magnetic resonance in one project, which looked at blood flow in the brain while people listened to music. What did you find?
Well, we've done a number of these studies, Jane, and with my colleague Vinod Menon at Stanford University Medical School. We put people in the scanner, the MRI machine, and we have them listen to music. I think one of the most interesting things we found is that when people listen to music they like, a kind of reward center lights up or becomes activated that includes some structures like the nucleus accumbens and the ventral tegmental area. Now, I know these aren't household words, but they're well known in neuroscience as being part of the pleasure center. They modulate dopamine levels in the brain. Now, you've heard of dopamine. That's the feel-good hormone. It's, you know, some of the newer generation of antidepressants act on the dopamine system to help put you in a better mood. When you listen to music you like, dopamine changes. Think of it as a shot of happy juice when you hear something you like.
Hmm. You say that what people like. I mean, what makes a person like particular music? What makes one person want to jump off the couch and start singing into the hairbrush, and another person thinks the same song makes them just want to jump out the window?
Did you do that this morning?
Yeah. My 4-year-old does it all the time.
Well, you know, it's funny because, the science of aesthetic taste is really in its infancy. We don't even know why some people like chocolate and some people don't, or why some people like spicy foods and others don't. And the same is true of music. We all differ from one another in a lot of different ways. But what we do know is that musical preferences are formed starting in the womb. Mm-hmm. Infants begin to become accustomed to the structures of the music they hear then. And what I tell young parents is that they should play their children as much variety of music as they can get their hands on. Classical, jazz, bluegrass, hip-hop. Give their, Iranian music, Pakistani music, Chinese opera. Give their children the opportunity to learn all these different forms. And then as young adults, they can choose what it is they want to listen to with that as a background.
Speaking of breaking out into spontaneous song, here's a clip. After eating gruel for weeks on end, the Workhouse Boys from the famous musical Oliver, you got it. They fantasize about good food. Back to the notion of joy, Daniel Levitin.
You were talking about dancing with the hairbrush. It's hard to imagine those kids singing and not moving.
Yes.
And it brings up an interesting neurological point, which is that when people listen to music, the parts of the brain that would normally move the body, the motor cortex, the cerebellum, they're active even if you're perfectly still. It suggests an ancient connection between music and movement. In fact, any physicist will tell you that you can't make music. There can't be sound without some sort of movement, whether you're blowing or plucking or scraping or banging on something or even just shoving air through your vocal cords, there's movement.
Speaking of movement, I think of the famous Boston Pops conductor Keith Lockhart. He was part of one of your experiments, wasn't he?
Yeah, he and the BSO were extraordinarily generous. They let us come in to an actual concert and wire up Maestro Lockhart, some of the members of the orchestra, and some of the members of the audience. And what we were looking for was some neurophysiological signature of the emotions. And preliminarily, what my colleague Steve McAdams and I have found is that when the conductor first has the notion of an emotional response to the music, it occurs in his body, and we measure it in a change in heart rate or in pulse or in respiration. And then we see it in the musicians a few seconds later and then in the audience a few seconds after that.
I just say because he's flipping his head around and he's got that baton going all the time, Keith Lockhart. So does the audience respond to that when they see the movement along with the singing? Does that elicit some sort of response in their brains chemically?
You're absolutely right. It does. We have discovered in the brain something called mirror neurons. These are neurons. You can think of them as monkey see, monkey do neurons. They were originally discovered in monkeys. But when we see somebody performing an action, automatically and without your conscious awareness, your brain is trying to figure out, what would I have to do to make that same movement?
So interesting. Here's another form of music. Music isn't always about having something written down. In fact, groups like Central Africa's Akha Pygmies make up songs and dances on the spot. And here we have improvised drumming and singing. About the ritual nature of music, Daniel.
I know this piece, and it may sound a little bit out of tune to some people, but they're just using a different scale and that we're not acculturated to, so it's difficult for us to appreciate. And one of the things that humans do, a lot of behaviors between animals and humans fall along a continuum. So a number of animals have rituals, dogs circling before they lie down, bower birds making a bower or a kind of a maypole to attract a mate. And, we humans have rituals too. Humans, though, are the only species that actually stops and wonders things like, why are we here? Who created us? Is there an afterlife? Is there a God? And out of that came one of the categories of song, religious songs.
Well, talk about that, how religious music fits into that sort of ritual nature of music.
Well, an interesting thing is that rituals, in humans anyway, become infused with meaning. The dog doesn't know why it's circling. But humans attach, invent, or are given by the creator, if you're religious, a belief that the rituals mean something and that they're being done for a purpose. I bow a certain number of times and I say a certain formula, and then the gods will, or God will, the creator will intercede in order to, you know, cure my sick child. Religious songs have had a very fundamental and important role in the creation of society by giving us a structure within which we contemplate our own existence, giving us a sense that the world isn't just running at the whim of capricious forces, but there's an order to things. Mm. In that respect, Jane, I think that monotheism was one of the huge cultural developments in our species. Before that, humans tended to think that really, you know, there was no order to things. There was no logic. Things were at the whim of capricious gods. But with monotheism came the notion, whether you're a theist or an atheist, doesn't matter. It ushered in the notion that things happen for a reason, and that gave way to the age of science. Mm.
And then beyond that, the next step, in my mind, that ritual and religious music enforces the importance of communal gathering. And you talk in your book about communal singing and people gathering together to make music as a group. Why is that important?
Well, if you look, again, to look at this, I guess, biologically, most primates don't live in groups with more than 18 males. The reason is that there's too much rivalry and dominance challenging, and they break apart.
Yeah.
But humans have been living in groups of a million or more for the last few thousand years. And anthropologists and biologists tell us that one of the roles that music played here was to ease interpersonal tensions, to defuse potential combative moments. You play music with somebody and you develop a special bond, partially through the release of oxytocin and dopamine, but also because it requires you to sort of coordinate with the other person. You have to think about what they're doing. You can't just think about what you're doing. It draws you out of yourself. Mm. You've got to time your... In the case of the pygmies, you notice that some of them were singing in unison. Others were singing exactly out of phase, filling in the gaps of the others. Mm. It really requires an effort on your part to get outside yourself, to think about others. Mm.
I find this so fascinating. Let's go to the phones and hear from some of our callers. Thurman is on the line from Destin, Florida. Hi, Thurman. Welcome to On Point.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'm calling. Curious, have you studied the effect of, this is one of my favorite things to do, with our friends, we'll pick what we call a cheesy 80s song and we'll all of a sudden start singing it out of nowhere and get it stuck in the person's head. And then for what can be days, sometimes even weeks, that melody just sticks in their head and they keep going. For people to say, I was made for loving you, baby. You were made for loving me. Right?
Are you a professional musician?
Thanks a lot for that.
Yeah. Thurman, thanks for the call. It's a good point. What makes a certain song get stuck in our brains, Daniel Levitin?
Well, first, I think the interesting thing is that they do get stuck. That suggests to a scientist that, you know, maybe songs were intended to get stuck. You know, we were talking earlier about the passing down of knowledge, encoding information like which animals are dangerous. You know, the modern version of the knowledge song, of course, is that every child learns the alphabet through a song. Hmm. Many of them learn to count through counting songs. Sesame Street teaches you, you know, how to spell or grammar, things like that. The fact that music gets stuck in there suggests that there's an evolutionary reason it does. Evolution selected music as an important way of communication or knowledge preservation. These things that Thurman was referring to are called earworms. And I haven't studied them personally, but there's a bit of a literature on it. And they tend to be just 20 seconds of a song, not the whole song, which could incidentally is exactly the length of auditory short-term memory.
Hmm. Mm. Back to the phones now. Andy has a question. He's in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Andy. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I
I play music, and ever since a little kid, like, it's been a huge part of my life. I can pick up a melody after hearing it the first time. I don't remember lyrics, though, but melodies are no problem. My question is, why is it that some people have such an easy time with playing music or humming a tune or carrying a tune, and other people are completely hopeless? Is it a learned behavior? Because I was always surrounded by music, or is it preordained that some people can play and perform and other people can't?
Great question, Andy. Is it innate, Daniel Levitin, or is music learned?
From what we know, it looks like it's 50-50. 50% environment, 50% genetics. So some people have a genetic propensity for a better auditory memory, for a better ability to hold sounds in mind or manipulate them, transpose them. And then, of course, that genetic propensity has to be activated. You have to be exposed to music and you have to practice. And then it all comes together.
Hmm. Here's another question from Magu, who's in Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jane.
Sure.
Very, very wonderful program on so many levels. And I can imagine all of us in the audience thinking how music interacts in our lives in so many ways, from birth to death. And although that one of the things I would like to say is that I just got an email from Armenia, where I live, from an opera singer, and she's asking me to bring back Negro spirituals and scores for piano. That interest is so much there. Just last November, Dubai sent to Armenia five empty planes. They were dedicating the new palms. And what they were picking up was exactly what your guest was talking about, singers and dancers. They were just bereft in that beautiful place of singers and dancers. And I can see how much that is important.
Mm.
But today, I was visiting people in nursing home. I work with the people with Alzheimer's, and a colleague of mine, Dr. Jade Mahakian, told me a story for your guest. There was someone in third stage of Alzheimer's. She discovered that the woman was Persian. She collected some lullabies in Persian, and she told the staff to play the tape and do not stop playing the tape. And nothing happened in the first 2 days, but on the third day, she awoke and spoke. I tried that with a radio program. I went into an Alzheimer's unit. There was a woman sleeping. I said, this radio program has this woman's music. Please put it on. Within 1 minute, within 1 minute, she was standing and dancing.
Magu makes a couple of interesting points. We've seen in old age homes people with Alzheimer's or brain damage, dementia. Music seems to be a preserved channel of communication. And that suggests, again, an ancient evolutionary basis for music. The brain selected special circuits to carry music that seem to be deep enough in the brain that they are often the last to go.
Hmm. Is there evidence, Daniel Levitin, that animals show an appreciation for music?
Well, my colleague Ani Patel from the Neurosciences Institute has looked into this, and a number of others. There is no other species that can synchronize with a beat, right? Mm. Notwithstanding of popular YouTube video of a parrot that seems to be dancing to to some music, there's no accepted scientific evidence of any animal synchronizing. Now, chimpanzees and elephants will bang drums and things, but the second chimp or elephant who comes into the picture doesn't synchronize with the first. Hmm. So humans are the only ones that can do that. And that seems to me an important aspect, although it's not all of music. It's an important aspect of music.
Hmm. Daniel Levitin, the book is The World in Six Songs. Mr. Levitin is the McGill Professor at the Laboratory of Science Perception, Cognition, and Expertise. He's produced records for musicians all over the world, including for Blue Oyster Cult, Stevie Wonder, Chris Isaac, hundreds of them. His new book, The World in Six Songs, is what we're talking about today. You can join our conversation. How has music evolved over these many years? What's your strongest musical memory? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. More to come and your phone calls. Hold the line. We'll be right back after this break. This is On Point.
Just to get by, just to get by, just to get by. My pants sing like John Lennon. Imagine all the people watch me rock like Paul McCartney from now until the last Beatles drop. What? I woke up feeling brand new and I jumped up feeling my high and my low.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about how songs, how music shapes the way we think about ourselves and strengthens our bonds with other people. You can join our conversation, What Was Playing When You Danced Last Night with Your Sweetheart? When is the last time you sang a song or cut a rug? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me this hour is Daniel Levitin, professor of music, neuroscience, and psychology at McGill University in Montreal, and the author of the new book, The World in Six Songs, How the Musical Brain Created Human Nature. I'd like to bring another voice into our conversation at this point. Joining me from New York is singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash. She has 11 number one hits on the Billboard country charts, including My Baby Thinks He's a Train and I Don't Want to Spoil the Party. Her most recent album is Black Cadillac. Roseanne Cash, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
So in his book, Daniel Levitin says that music is, quote, an honest signal. What can you say in a song that you can't say perhaps any other way?
Well, I really like that description, by the way. I sometimes feel as a songwriter that musically I'm trying to get behind what words can convey, that there's some deeper meaning or there's some more essential truth that you can't get in any other way except through music. So, you know, just to try to touch that has kind of an air of the transcendent about it.
Mm. Many of your best-known songs, like Blue Moon with a Heartache and I Don't Know Why You Don't Want Me, they're all about a spurned lover or a relationship gone bad or the bitter feelings right after a fight of some sort. What is it about those songs that you think resonates with listeners?
Well, I think that I've developmentally grown out of those songs in a lot of ways. Those songs were much earlier in my life and in my career, and as I've matured into larger themes. I think that as a young songwriter in my 20s and early 30s, that was the topic. Romantic love is just obsesses you. You know, the particular details of all of romantic love in every way. Mm. And then you start looking out at the world and there are other themes. I mean, Black Cadillac is about death and ancestry, loss, connection, the future. You know, romantic love takes a back seat. it's not important.
Yeah. But here's one of your songs. In it, we hear about unconditional love for someone who plays many roles for the narrator.
I love you like a brother, a father and a son. It may not last forever, ever, but it never will be done. My whole world fits inside the moment I saw you. That day was filled with roses.
Hmm. That's God is in the Roses, one of your songs from 2006. I'm curious, Roseanne Cash, do you make changes to your music when you're playing music with a group of people instead of by yourself?
Yes,
absolutely. In what way?
Well, you have to accommodate the other musicians you're working with, number one, and it becomes more orchestral if I'm working with more than one musician.
And what about with an audience?
Well, that's interesting because that's one reason I love performances, because it's so ephemeral and it does change every night depending on who the audience is and what chemistry they bring. And sometimes I'll change a word in a song that I've sung for 25 years based on just some feeling that came up that night. And that's fun. That's exciting.
Mm. As a performer, can you feel the sort of shift when you sing a particular song? We're talking with Daniel Levitin about what actually happens in the brain chemically. Can you feel it as such a seasoned performer? Can you feel changes?
If I can let go, I can feel the changes. Mm. And that's pretty much true for everything else in life.
Mm.
Some nights, a song like God is in the Roses that you just played is very sad to me and has a very elegiac feeling. And some nights it just feels absolutely liberating.
Hmm.
So I think the particular song responds to where you are in the moment as well.
Roseanne Cash, joining us from New York City. Thank you so much for your time, Roseanne.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I'm a huge fan of Daniel Levitin, and I'm really enjoying this book, by the way.
Thank you, and thank you so much. Let's go to the phones again now. Jean is on the line from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Jean. Welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
I just wanted to go on record as saying that I'm in favor of participatory music for all ages, but my question has to do with kids' songs and the hand movements that you sometimes do with kids' songs.
Mm.
Recently I was singing with some kids and I was showing them the hand movements from the song All God's Critters Got a Place in the Choir by Bill Staines. And when you were talking, I was wondering whether these things, they're so ubiquitous, you know, Itsy Bitsy Spider, whether these things have a particular important developmental kind
of... Oh, they absolutely do, because they're teaching the young child hand-eye coordination, motor coordination, and synchronization. These are important skills, and, you know, in hunter-gatherer societies, you needed to grasp for the berry and pull it at just the right time. You can't pull before you've grasped.
Hmm.
I mean, it's training the motor system. And when you do it in synchrony with music, this is I'm glad you asked this question because it gets to the heart of what I think the book is about, which is how music actually helped to form human society. Many of the great civic undertakings, the Roman aqueducts, the Egyptian pyramids, the kinds of things we associate with civilization, those were made possible by groups of people working in synchrony, usually synchronizing their movements and their efforts to music. Think of chain gang songs and work songs, whistle while you work. It's the idea that uniquely, sure, you can synchronize your movements with another worker by looking at them, but then you're taking your eye off your work.
Hmm.
Music, sound allows you to synchronize without taking your eyes off your work. And that's an important thing.
You mentioned music in early civilizations. You talk in the book a lot about music used in therapy in Egyptian and Indian and Native American cultures, right?
Yeah, it's been known for a long time that music has an effect on mood. And we now know that when people listen to music, and even more so when they play music, it can help boost the immune system by helping the production of immunoglobulin A. And I think at a more cognitive level or a more emotional level, music helps us to make sense of the world. I was thinking about Roseanne's songs, and I'm a huge fan of her music, and I often listen to Roseanne Cash songs because they help me to better understand how I feel about something when I'm not sure myself. I think we've all had the experience, the right song comes on and we say, yeah, that's how I feel. This person articulated for me when I couldn't find the words.
Mm, that's so interesting. Back to the phones now. To Virginia Beach, Virginia. Lexi is on the line. Hi, Lexi.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
My question is about universal sound and chanting and the effects physiologically of those things. I teach yoga and I use only Tibetan singing bowls and just pure sound rather than any words. And I've been told that that helps connect us to an energy. Is there some physiological response? Because all cultures seem to have chanting. Hmm. Thank you.
Lexi, thanks.
It's true, and we were talking about ritual earlier, and the caller Magu was talking about life cycle events like birth and death, and music is a part of all these kinds of important phases of life, and particularly in non-industrial cultures, it's used in a kind of way to induce a trance state. What the caller is talking about, chanting without lyrics, we now know invoke different parts of the brain than music with lyrics. It helps to turn off the kind of, literal or logical analysis part of the brain. And when the music has just the right tempo, we know that neurons start to fire in synchrony with it, and it can promote a kind of altered state of consciousness.
Hmm. Music is a sort of antidepressant in some ways?
Absolutely. As a couple of women told Joni Mitchell, before there was Prozac, there was you.
Charlie is on the line now from East Quag, New York. Hi, Charlie. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Hi.
Hi,
Daniel. A question that I have for Daniel. Your six categories are all very positive. And that's all well and good, but then it's interesting to me that you break with Jimi Hendrix's Manic Depression.
Mm-hmm.
a song about a man suffering so badly from bipolar disorder that it may well have ultimately led to his suicide. So we have songs of war and songs of loss of love, which are a big part of our society and all societies, songs of death, which Roseanne Cash alluded to, and songs of the loss of health, spiritual, mental, physical, emotional. And these very songs release negative chemicals, adrenaline, cortisoids, things of that sort. How come you haven't explored that more in your book? And I'll take my answer off the line. Good talking with you, and I enjoyed the discussion very much.
Charlie, thanks. Daniel Levitin?
Well, I do go into this in quite a bit of detail in the book, and you take the case of a sad song. It releases, in many cases, listening to sad music will release the hormone prolactin, which is a comforting hormone, not all negative. In the particular cases the caller mentioned, I would say that a song like Manic Depression is a knowledge song. The writer is telling us about an experience that he had that he's trying to preserve for others and communicate. The war songs I put in the category of social bonding, because although war has a negative impact on the people that are being warred against, a lot of times the music is used to bond the unit together so that they can feel some solidarity with one another.
Hmm. Chris is on the line now from Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thanks.
Sure.
Daniel, I read your last book. I really liked it. I got a lot out of it. I got a quick question for you. Years ago, I took my 15-year-old rebellious son to, he really begged me to get a tattoo, so I took him to get this tattoo. And for an hour or more in the shop, they were playing this music that was just so absolutely discordant and atonal, and I could not wait to get out of that place. And I got out of there later on. I reflected on it and thought about why it made me feel so angry the way I did. And then I thought about those people who reacted to Stravinsky's Light of Spring the way they did, and wondered if there weren't some similar things going on with my reaction, and if you could kind of dissect that visceral reaction for me a little bit.
Thanks, Chris.
You know, I think the job of the artist is twofold. It's to not take anything for granted and to seek the truth. And those things are very difficult to do. And this is why we end up with artists pushing the boundaries and sometimes making stuff that we don't like or that it takes us a while to learn to like, because they're employing techniques or structures. And this applies to painting, ballet, music. They're exploring truth and communicating it in a new way, and they're not taking for granted the traditional modes of expression. And I think art has been evolving for thousands of years, and each generation tries to find its own voice.
Hmm. That's an interesting point. Thanks for the call. Jacob is up next from Daytona Beach, Florida. Hi, Jacob. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I wanted to ask if he knows of any studies that have been done linking music with decision-making or opinion-forming, such as if you watch a documentary that has inspirational music, will you be more likely to believe the points that are presented in that documentary?
Hmm. Thanks, Jacob.
Yeah, there is some research on this, and of course, films use music for just this purpose, to invoke a mood. There was a famous study done that showed that they took an otherwise ambiguous film scene of a man following a woman, and they played either scary, like Hitchcockian music, or romantic Strauss-type music. And the interpretation of the scene was completely biased by what kind of music was there. Music does disambiguate what might otherwise be a confusing or ambiguous scene. And there's research showing that classical music played in liquor stores actually bumps up the average price of the sale.
Listen, we're running out of time. We could go another hour with you. This is so fascinating, Daniel. We're going to leave this hour with a well-known song by John Lennon. And I know you visited the hotel room at the Fairmont Queen Elizabeth where this was recorded. Can you tell me the story and how you reacted to that experience?
Well, Oliver Sacks was visiting Montreal, and we had breakfast together, and he had gotten put into the John Lennon Yoko Ono suite at the hotel because, you know, the people recognized he was a celebrity, and they gave him the best room they had.
And he was telling me this over breakfast. He knew that I was a Lennon fan and invited me up to the room. And it was extraordinary because I remember watching the television reports on the Huntley-Brinkley show of the bed-in, the famous peace thing in 1969 where John and Yoko were holed up in the hotel for a week with Timothy Leary and Tommy Smothers. And we went to the room, and I was overcome with emotion just to see the room. And there were pictures on the wall of John recording Give Peace a Chance. And I think part of it for me as a child of the 50s and 60s was that there was this childlike innocence and optimism about Lennon, that he really believed that he could change the world with a song. Hmm. And maybe he did.
Hmm. Our guest this hour has been Daniel Levitin. His latest book is called The World in Six Songs, How the Musical Brain Created Human Nature. Fascinating. Thank you for your work, and thanks for your time today, Daniel.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Ping Huang, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsanis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Sam Gale Rosen, Will Roselip, Samina Yudin, and our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. My thanks to this terrific staff for all their work. It's been great to be with you these last 2 weeks. Tom Ashbrook is back on Monday. I'm Jane Clayson. Have a great weekend. This is On Point.